Hey folks, I'm here to talk to you about Austin Pets Alive. I am here with Dr. Ellen Jefferson from Austin Pets Alive. And can you tell us, Ellen, exactly what Austin Pets Alive is?
Sure. We are a nonprofit organization and we save over 6,000 dogs and cats at risk for euthanasia every year.
Oh, wow. How do you do that?
Well, we have a shelter down at Town Lake Animal Center, and we pull animals off of the euthanasia list at the city, but also at surrounding shelters, and animals that have no other options, and they're on death row, minutes away from euthanasia, we pull them and save their lives.
Wow. And so you guys need a lot of help because you're not funded by anyone except the people.
Yep, that's right.
The community.
That's right.
So people can get involved by going to austinpetsalive.org, and how can they get involved?
There are a lot of ways to get involved. The biggest ways are adopting. Of course, we need these animals to go into homes.
Yeah.
So adopting, fostering, opening up a home opens up a cage. So if somebody opens up their home for an animal, we can go rescue another animal that's about to die and put that one in the cage that one just vacated. Volunteering, 50% of our program is run by volunteers. So having volunteers are critical. And then, of course,
dog walkers.
Dog walkers are really big. Yes, that's one of our biggest basic needs. And then donating, of course. We can't do this without donations.
And people can donate straight to the site, austinpetsalive.org.
Yes.
Okay. And you're focusing right now on the bigger dogs. And I just did an ad for you guys where a lot of musicians, almost over 30 musicians have done it already.
Almost 50.
Wow. And they're trying to get specific dogs. I posed with Calimán and Apache. And do you feel like this is a success? People can take those pictures and pass them along, even if they're not from Austin. Send this stuff, you know, around, because these are dogs that you might know someone in Austin that's ready to foster, ready to adopt.
Yes, definitely. The campaign is about that individual dog. But it's also about that type of dog. So even if it doesn't inspire an adoption here, if it inspires an adoption in Omaha, Nebraska, awesome. That
it's
saved
all
a life.
Worth it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you can go to austinpetsalive.org, just the website, but you can also like the Facebook page, Austin Pets Alive. You can follow them on Twitter, and you can follow them on Instagram and share pictures of cute dogs with all your friends.
Yes.
And help a grassroots organization that has saved over 20,000 dogs to this day already.
Mm-hmm.
Or 20,000 animals, I should say.
30,000 animals,
wow.
Probably close to 20,000 dogs.
Wow. Amazing. Is there anything I'm missing?
No, I think that's it.
People can go to austinpetsalive.org and get involved.
Yes, please
do. Do that, people. Thank you.
Thanks.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
Time for How Did I Get Here? And now here is your host, Johnny Howdy.
All right. Hello. I'm Johnny. I'm your host. Welcome to the show. Before we get into it, I have great news concerning Austin Pets Alive. I did this photo shoot with a dog that's up for adoption, a couple of dogs actually, a few weeks ago, and they posted them online, and one of the dogs, Calimán, actually got adopted. So it's working. So get out there to austinpetsalive.org, find yourself a dog if you live in Austin, or spread the word if you're not from Austin to your friends in Austin that these dogs need adoption to keep Austin a no-kill city. Okay? Thank you so much. I have a great show for you guys today. My guest is guitar virtuoso Angus Clark. Now, a couple weeks ago, when I was in New York, I got together with Angus, and he came over to my hotel room in the weird part of Brooklyn called Bed-Stuy, which I did not know was a little sketchy, but it was. Anyway, Angus is an amazing guitar player who I met through Song Division, this company that does these songwriting sort of events at corporate retreats, and he explains it really well in the thing, so I'm going to leave it to him to explain it. But anyway, he is the guitar player for Trans-Siberian Orchestra. He plays in the Rock of Ages on Broadway. He plays guitar in the band there. He has a band called Daredevil Squadron. He is a guitar instructor. There's tons of things online that you can find. He's hired by a company where he goes down to Orlando, I think he said, and teaches guitar lessons. The guy is just amazing. His name's Angus Clark. He's a fantastic musician, a great guy, and he came to my hotel room. We sat down and talked when I was in New York. It was great. Okay, so before we get to that, let me tell you what's going on with me. I'm starting my residency at Strange Brew here in Austin next Tuesday, July 1st. Okay, I'm doing a songwriter showcase where I'm having two other songwriters play with me. It's not going to be in the round, but what's going to happen is the first guy will go on. It's going to be a seamless show. That's what I'm calling it. It's totally seamless. So once the first guy goes on, it doesn't end until the last guy goes off. So the way it goes is, first guy goes on, plays his set, I join him for his last song, he leaves the stage, I play a set, the last guy comes on for my last song, plays it with me, then I leave and that guy finishes his set. Okay? That's what it's going to be. And I'm going to be doing it for July and August at Strange Brew. My guests this week are two of my very best friends, guys I love playing music with, Jeremy Nail and Joseph King. And I've got a lot of great guests coming up. I mean, Salim Nirala, I've got Kurt Newman from the Bodines, Elizabeth McQueen, a lot of great songwriters, AJ Vallejo, Kendall Beard, many, many. So look out for that. Go to Johnny Gowdy Music on Facebook, and you'll be seeing, I'll be putting up a new song every week on Facebook for download from SoundCloud. Just go and like that page and you'll find out what's going on with me and who the guests will be. The shows start at 8. They'll be every Tuesday through July and August. I'm very excited about it. So come on out, check it out, and do it. I just played this last Tuesday with Jeff Plankenhorn, who's had the residency there for the last couple of years. And it was a great show, man. I sat in with Casey Crowley, who's also going to be playing my show. Sat in with Jeff Plankenhorn, with Will Knack. It was a great time. Yogi, all these great musicians. We had a great show and everything was fantastic. So that's what's going on. I'm heading out to Houston on Saturday to play with Skyrocket for the closing of Rockefeller's down there. That's a great place. I don't know what it's going to be. I hope it's not going to be apartments. I thought it was an historical building, so maybe they can't tear it down. Anyway, that's what's going on with me, you guys. So before we talk to Angus, let me read this quick tweet that I got from this guy named Jim Eggers on Twitter. He is jeggers8. That's at jeggers8. It says, "So, my friend, do I get a shout-out on the next podcast? I need a t-shirt, my friend. A Johnny Gowdy t-shirt would be rad." Yes, it would, man. I need to make some shirts. And you know what? Listen, keep on listening to the show. Keep on telling people about it, Jim. And I will keep on giving out shout-outs to people. Thank you so much for helping promote the show. All right? Let's travel back in time and to New York City, actually to Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn, and sit down and talk to my good friend, Angus Clark, the great guitar player. All right? It's a great conversation. He's a great guy. You guys have a great weekend. Let's get down.
When they ask, what do you say? Do you smile? Do you laugh all their questions away? How do you answer for why I'm not there? Do you think it's over and done? 'Cause there's a place in my heart where it's only begun. It's
close to the mean. I met you through Song Division.
Yes.
And can you explain it? 'Cause it's always hard for me to explain it.
What Song Division is?
Exactly.
So we're a company that facilitates having non-musicians write songs as a big group,
right?
Assisted by professional musicians,
right?
And we use this process that we developed for a variety of different things, mostly in the corporate meetings and conventions market. Right. So it can function as a team building exercise where, you know, if it's medium to small size groups, you know, we get them sitting down and brainstorming lyrics, ideas, things about, you know, what they're working on, what they do, why they like doing it, what's important about it. You know, a lot of the clients are, pharmaceutical companies where they're very driven by, you know, helping people with health issues and right. So on and so forth. But there's also just a lot of sales staff, and they just, you know, they need motivational activities for them. And what's fun about it is they get to write a song, a completely original song. They're not rewriting lyrics to something right. else. We have this whole process worked out so that they write their own song. And, you know, they're taking ownership of some messaging or something that maybe the leadership in their company, like, has been wanting them to,
yeah.
you know, kind of right. get on top of. But this is the opportunity for them to kind of put it in their mouths and really say it.
Yeah.
And it's in the event, it's really about them having fun working with each other on something that's not what they're ordinarily working on.
Right.
And so it's team building. It also functions in the same space at a big meeting. They'll have, you know, like a bunch of people in a ballroom like all day.
Yeah.
And then they'll have something short that's more fun and engaging. And
right.
So we're just like, oh, suddenly there's a rock band playing.
Right.
And we do this song for with them, written with them really quickly. And it's just
very quick. I mean, that was, you know, that's, I mean, to me, that's always the best way to do it, to not just, you know, labor forever over something. And that's, so far, all the ones we've ended up with songs that I remember. You know what I mean?
It's that's one of the craziest and most maddening things about the entire experience is that we go in with nothing.
Yeah.
We don't, you know, we maybe have ideas, they maybe have a slogan or something like that. That you know, and we're thinking about it. And then the participants come up with the chorus. And I literally just did one in San Diego where they had a fairly involved like slogan, like the spec of what they wanted the song to be was kind of hard to turn it into a hook.
Right.
But so I had a whole idea of a hook just in case.
Yeah.
And we had to get the whole song written in 45 minutes with like about 500 people in the room. And sure enough, somebody came up with like almost the same thing I had, but maybe one better. And I was so relieved. I was just like, oh man, I don't have to, you know, we don't have to prefab anything.
Yeah,
we just go with what the people give us.
Have you ever come across something where it there's like a gridlock and you can't get past something? Because I've felt that a couple of times coming on, like but it just goes through anyway, and it's still, you know what I mean? It's, like no one gets stuck on something. Or
well, that's interesting. I mean, that's like that is in when we, you know, develop the format. It, you know, it's the kind of thing like, you know, you have to sell it to the client.
Yeah.
And they have, you know, they're nervous about whether or not like you're gonna hit stumbling blocks. And the thing is that you do, but they work out.
Yeah.
And that's another reason why it proves out so well for the people we're working for, because they, you know, they get it's just like anything they do at work, you know, you're chronically putting out fires, you know, things don't happen in the ideal. And it's a creative process that plays out very quickly for people. Like, oh, we got to solve this.
Right.
And I mean, you know, and sometimes somebody in the band will be like, why don't we, and as much as like that's somebody in the band helping them finish it, at the same time, like that's what we do. I mean, that's what we do in bands, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I will say, like, I bring it up, you know, that hey, you know, like Paranoid, right, was like the last tune on that album written with like, you know, oh, we've still got, you know, 5 minutes of studio, we got 5 minutes of time left on the
record.
Yeah. You know, we got another, you know, whatever,
yeah,
like hour here to record it. And they wrote like kind of the whole thing in 10 minutes, you know, Geezer Butler wrote out the lyrics and like, you know, and done.
That's unbelievable.
That, you know, that's Paranoid. Yeah. So,
it can be done. Kismet, it like strikes, it's all beautiful and everything lines up. So one more question about it. Well, how did you get involved? Did they like find you, or did you know someone that was starting it? Or
I was called through a studio in New York that was called Skyline. I'm not sure what it's called now. At the time, it was operated by a drummer named Jonathan Mover, mm-hmm. who's he's fairly well known, and he, like to me, I always knew him as the fact that he had been in Marillion for a minute, which was like one of my Prague.
That's a big
my Prague things. But he was also in, I think, GTR with Steve Hackett and Steve Hackett.
Wow.
And he's like, and some Joe Satriani stuff and stuff like that. Anyway, he owns and operates this studio. He's friends with another one of the guitar players in the TSO, Al Petrelli. So he got a call that Song Division was started in Australia. They booked two sessions in New York just to demonstrate the you know, the process.
Mm-hmm.
And they booked it at Skyline and left Jonathan with the task of putting together the band. And so I was on his call list.
Okay.
And wound up playing guitar on it. And I had fun doing it. I've always written lyrics, so that part was easy for me. A lot of side, you know, when we hire now, it's interesting for us to find the right guys who are both, you know, high quality session musicians, but have any interest in lyrics and
right.
you know, writing lyrics and some facility with it.
Yeah.
Because some guys, you know, just leave that off the the docket if they go straight into the session world and they're, you know, just really good at, you know, laying down the bass groove. They'll just kind of not get the lyric writing thing
right.
together for themselves. So I had fun with it. And then and that's what the Andy Sharp, who founded the company, ran that. And I did those two sessions, and then Andy went back to Australia, and I was kind of like, man, that was really fun.
Yeah.
And so I looked him up online and sent him an email and said, hey, thanks, you know, you get, you know, are you thinking about doing that in the States some more? And it started from there. We got busier. And
yeah.
That's it.
That's great. And you know, it is. I think that it takes like when you go in to do it for the first time, it's so different than what you do, but it's so fast, fun, and easy, and you're kind of hanging out with friends, and you know what I mean? It's not really work. And you get to actually see, like we were watching your daughter's performance, see people that don't normally do that stuff. You help them do it, and there is a great satisfaction to see, like, the excitement when they've, you know, when they hear the completed song.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, it's so cool.
Because it's the same moment, like, for us as performers, right? I mean, I'm always struck by, man, as different as things get throughout your life, like, there's a lot of things that happen on my very first gig that are, like, no different.
Yeah.
Like,
exactly.
All the way from the, whatever it was, mine was student organization jam at Bronx Science, right?
Yeah.
Like, from that gig, or the first one I ever did in a club when I was, like, 18 or something, all the way to, you know, the TSO tour, whatever, you know, arena. There may be more people working on it and stuff like that, but there's still just so many things that are exactly the same.
Yeah.
It's like, ah, I can't hear myself.
Yeah.
It's like, you're always going to need to hear yourself.
So I want to go back to the beginning. Where are you from?
New York City.
This is your place.
Yeah, Upper West Side, 110th and Riverside.
Wow. Yeah. Did you come from a musical family?
My mother was a singer, opera.
Oh, really?
Singer. Yep. And my dad always enjoyed singing, but his instrument was the cello, but he was not a professional. He was a lawyer. Hmm.
But so music was there in the house, and let me ask you this question, is always the one. Did you ask to learn an instrument, or did they say, hey, you're gonna learn? What was the first, did you learn piano first or something?
It was both. At first it was them, you know, sending, you know, which one do you want to do? And
right.
I think both my brother and I were taking the violin, but I was in Suzuki classes, which are like group classes and stuff, and I was just like, I don't get it.
Yeah.
You know? And there was some piano, it was at a school, so it was like a piano thing involved as well. And I was just, you know, I don't know, maybe I got in that because I was younger. So then when I wound up with the private lessons, I was taking cello, and I hated it.
Yeah.
I didn't practice, was out of there. And then I think I was really into watching The Monkees, which was already in reruns.
Not that old.
And, you know, it was on at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon on, you know, the local station.
Yeah.
They showed The Monkees. You know, and I was like all into that. So I wanted to take the guitar. So my parents, like, you know, asked two friends and, of course, got directed to a classical teacher. So there I was, you know, with this nylon string guitar and like the Aaron Shearer, you know, method books. And it was just like, this has nothing to do with playing.
Like, this isn't what those guys are doing on TV.
Yeah.
I had that when I first took lessons. This lady would make us learn like these awful songs, and they were just stupid, and it was just, I was almost like discouraged by the whole experience.
It was crazy. And so I had the Monkees as this like visual reference, and I had the three rock albums in my parents' collection, which were Revolver, Sgt. Pepper's, and Beggar's Banquet.
Okay.
which are,
amazing albums.
You don't have to, can't do too much. If there's only going to be three, you're on a pretty good, three right there. So I had like that, but had a few, I don't know how many guitar lessons, but I mean, the guitar was heavier than me, it was like, I can't remember if that was like third or fourth grade. I was pretty young.
Wow.
And then I was in this choir, so there's always singing and stuff going on. And then The Wall came out, and then I was like, where's that guitar?
Yeah.
And let's go get some lessons. And they took me to a place where the guy just used, the Mel Bay modern method guitar.
I forgot about Mel Bay.
Oh, man. I did all eight books.
You did? I think I had the Mel Bay's Fun with Guitar. I think that's the one I had. So then you took from that guy, you learned the Mel Bay stuff, and then...
Yeah, and then... So that was like 7th or 8th grade, and so then I started getting into bands in high school, and it was just all, Pink Floyd, Black Sabbath, and Jethro Tull, and, And at that point, you had to, learn some Rush tunes, but I kind of got away from that eventually.
That must have been interesting for you, because you wrote a couple of songs with Anna Phoebe, who plays with Jethro Tull, and they performed songs that you wrote.
Yes.
How weird is that?
That was like the most awesome thing ever. Yeah. And I feel like it's probably lost on a lot of people, because Jethro Tull's, not really, that big right now.
But
for me, they were just an insanely huge influence, and I just loved everything about them. So, yeah, Anna was violin player for the Trans-Siberian Orchestra, who I play for.
Mm-hmm.
And we did, three or four tours together, and then I worked with her on this first record she did of instrumentals.
Right.
And, then Jethro Tull, for the last while, at some point in the last 10 years, he had added a female violin player, and he's mm-hmm. been through about three of them. One was Lucia Micarelli, who's now on TV show about New Orleans.
Tremé?
Yeah, she's on Tremé. She was on the gig, and then Anna was on the gig. And so whoever came in on that chair, Tull would play like two or three of their songs to feature them. So
that's cool.
They played two of the songs that I wrote with her. And Ian Anderson actually introduced one from the stage and said, this is one that she wrote with Angus Clark. Yeah.
That's awesome.
What's better than that?
Yeah, that's really cool. That's awesome. So wait, let's go back to high school. So when you started those bands, you were learning Tull, you were doing Sabbath, Pink Floyd. You were pretty influenced by David Gilmour.
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah,
totally had everything. I think I was telling you the other night at the Skyrocket gig that I found in this box the first quarter inch 8-track multi-track and it had Crazy Train and Comfortably Numb. I'd love to get it on an 8-track machine and mix it down and see what I played, because I'm sure it was pretty awful.
I mean, it might have been amazing. So this is interesting, because I feel like that's when I was going through your stuff today, I feel like there's such an technically, it's so great, right? It's sometimes when it gets so technical, you lose an emotion, but you still have a very emotional style, which when I was reading some stuff and I saw Gilmour in there, I was like, okay, so that totally makes sense, that no matter what you do, because there's this sort of crying feeling with Gilmour's playing.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's there's real feeling in there.
Well, thank you.
When
you say that, it just all makes me think it's all in how you bend the strings, right? That's what makes Jeff Beck kind of amazing to people. It was profound, David Gilmour, just the solos on The Wall. I mean, The Wall is like two things at the same time, right? It's like this amazing concept album, a really dark emotional material.
Yeah.
And we could talk about that, but that's a therapy session, right?
Yeah.
And then and then it's an album of amazing guitar solos.
Oh yeah.
just like one after the other.
Yeah, it's amazing,
like,
guitar
it's
solos.
Insane, yeah. Right? And if you listen to it like as a musician, kind of with a modern ear, what's amazing is the amount of direct to the board guitar there is on that record.
I didn't know that.
It's
like what? Is it direct guitar part?
Another Brick in the Wall Part 2 solo.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's what?
Straight into like one of those really high end tube compressors, like an LA-2A or something
right.
like that. All that compression on it. And what's amazing is that, you know, you watch all those pictures of David Gilmour with Strats, you know, I'm like, they're, you know, like, but, you know, it was the 80s, so my first good guitar was actually a Charvel with a Fender headstock, but then eventually I started just getting Strats, right?
Right.
And, you know, like it, more than half the solos on the wall are David Gilmour playing a Les Paul.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Yeah, so, yeah. Like, you know, you just kind of... you know, why am I not getting the sound?
Right.
It's like, yeah.
Well, just because of the sustain that he's able to have on there.
Yeah.
And totally comes from that.
Yeah, it's like the less Paul and just a compressor. You know, there's not a lot of, like, I don't think there was a lot of amp feedback or anything.
No.
You know, Gilmour, if we just get into it, right, the Animal, yeah. Animals is him on the Strat. Like, Animals is like an amp, the Strat.
Right.
And, like... You know, that's like this amazing rock sound
yeah.
for them.
Yeah,
and it's just that mix of instruments on that is insane. But the Wall is a production, you know, masterwork. But it has all this direct guitar. And it's like,
yeah, so cool. Whenever I think of direct guitar, I always think of like weird like Prince funk parts that he does direct too. But I don't equate it with the
funk and R&B are like
yeah.
the most amazing parts of some of the worst guitar sounds ever.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the most classic guitar
yeah.
sounds ever, right? I mean, Nile Rodgers, you know, totally. But then sometimes you're just like, of everything there is to put on a record, like, you guys went with that.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
It's really strange with all the amps they could have used and everything. What an odd choice. So did you continue studying, like, when you had the bands? Did you keep on taking lessons? Did you finally find someone that was helping you get to where you wanted to be?
I continued studying. I was a full-blown music student.
Yeah.
And you know, I think I was raised in a fairly traditional household.
Yeah.
There's just an expectation of going to college.
Right.
And I did that, you know. And I tried to, you know, study something that would be, you know, give me a fallback
yeah, yeah.
plan.
Yeah.
Electrical engineering, which I didn't even know what electrical engineering was. That's
right.
What's so funny is that, like, you know, I thought, I remember the band Boston?
Of course. Tom Schultz?
Brad Delp.
Oh, yeah.
So Tom Schultz had a mechanical engineering
yeah.
degree from MIT, which
right.
he wasn't even using, like, you know, really mechanical engineering. You know, like, I thought recording studios and all that stuff was really cool. And if you think about it, you know, the era that I, you know, went through, you know, it's the transition from tape to digital,
mm-hmm.
like, all happened, like, right, you know, under our noses,
yeah.
and it's amazing. So, the electrical engineering, for those that don't know, is the study of, like, IC chips and how to make, like, hardwired computers.
Right.
So there's a lot of, like, physics and material science, and you're making, you know, microscopic, like, circuitry that figures out, you know, and
right.
an or. And, I mean, yeah, that's probably how part of how you make a pod.
Right. Yeah.
You know? But, like, is that really a benefit to the world?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. Did you get a Rockman at that time?
I had a Rockman in college, yeah, yeah.
I had this thing that wasn't... I don't think it was an actual Rockman, but it also had a thing where you could sing too at the same time, which is weird.
It was probably part of it.
I think it might have been a knockoff thing.
Well, so I went to University of Southern California, and they have this amazing guitar program.
Mm-hmm.
So I was there in electrical engineering for like about a semester and a half, and then I was failing out of physics, so I dropped physics. And I finished that semester with, I don't know, like a D average. But by the time I finished that first semester, I was already a music major. I had like, the second semester,
right, right.
I had already switched. And so like, I went over to music, and they have a great program there. They still do. And, you know, it was LA in, like, you know, what was that, 85 to 89.
Wow.
So kind of like the Sunset Strip scene had already like spilled over or
right.
gone, you know, into the mainstream, and what was left was kind of Shredder, you know, Racer X, and Paul Gilbert and all kind of stuff was what was kind of left. I was a New Yorker in LA. I didn't know how to drive. I would take the bus to, you know, out to the Troubadour to go watch Racer X play, you know. And there were cats like that at SC, you know, like this one guy I remember, and if you're out there, Christian Arvan, I remember you. He was like, Paul Gilbert left Racer X. This guy who was at USC at the time,
right.
like took Paul Gilbert's spot in Racer X for like a minute, you know.
Wow.
And I was like, we were like, dude,
yeah, you know,
that was so amazing. So that's when, you know, all this technical stuff was happening. So I had to spend a lot of time playing, you know, the fast scales and get the speed picking down and, you know, all that. I just never got into tapping. It was I just kind of never went that.
Yeah.
That just, you know, just enough to play Crazy Train.
Right. It's got to be in there somewhere.
That's all I needed. And, but you just never lose touch with the thing that you listen to the most when you're 13. And for me, it's like David Gilmour and Tony Iommi. You know, it's like you just never. And it creeps up on you. It pops out in your playing when you listen. You know, you hit something in the middle of a tape somewhere, and you're like, "Who's that? Oh, that's me."
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. That's unmistakable. That I listened to The Wall a million times.
I have that too. Like with my own stuff, sometimes I get discouraged. And I'm like, "Oh, I gotta stop listening to music completely." So, so were you a Randy Rhoads guy?
Yeah.
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 Name all your heroes at that point, like when you were at school. Like who, obviously Gilmour, Tony Iommi.
Yeah, Gilmour, Tony Iommi, Randy Rhoads, Michael Schenker, and then Yngwie, and then Ritchie Blackmore. Like, I still think
there's a lot of Strat guys there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and Hendrix. You know, it's like, it's so deep, that whole thing. Like, I only started getting into, you know, owning or playing anything in the Gibson family within the last, like, 10 years. I started with an SG.
Yeah.
I went with
I saw a video of you playing one.
Went with the Tony Iommi thing. And now, you know, I've gotten into, like, the Flying V. And I just got a Les Paul, like, in the last 2 years. Because you kind of
have to. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's so interesting, like the Yngwie, you know, with all the chops and the crazy stuff, but still, I mean, that dude has amazing ears. Like you can't argue how badass he throws it down, man.
There's no, I had this conversation with Kyle Crusham a few months ago, cause he was on back to back episodes of that metal show, like playing, it's really unbelievable what he's doing. It's totally unbelievable.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it is. It's classical music.
Yeah, it's insane.
I mean, it really is.
And he's hearing it.
Yeah.
He's hearing whatever it is go by that fast.
Yeah.
That's like, I'm like, I can't. I mean, remember when you're really working on speed chops and stuff like that, you do start to hear more.
Right.
Like, you know, things start to slow down out there. In the Yngwie land of listening to that stuff. But it's so deep for him, you know, you kind of have to, and so I totally have insane respect for, and just, you know, the first five notes of the Yngwie Malmsteen's Rising Force record aren't even that fast. It's just like the one lick in Black Star. He's like, he does the classical intro, and then he goes, it's like, and it's, you know, it's that Strat tone.
Yeah.
It's not that distorted. It's very sparse what's going on around it. And you're just like, you just wake up to this, to the feel and the touch of what he was doing. It's amazing. And then, you know, I was just a huge Ronnie James Dio fan, and like, so I had, because I think at the time I was buying records, it was, you know, he was in Sabbath.
Mm-hmm.
So I had like Mob Rules and Heaven and Hell.
Right.
And then some kid at my high school was like, "Oh, you got to get those Rainbow records, man. Those are the ones, you know." And so then I went back and got Ritchie Blackmore's Rainbow and Rising and On Stage. And so On Stage, that's Blackmore alive, you know, the phase shifter and the delay on and the whole bit. And then I was just like, oh man, that's, I still just will sit there with the phase shifter and a delay on playing through my Marshall with a Strat and just be like, you know, can't get better than this.
No.
Like, can I get anybody to pay me to pay to see this? Yeah. Probably not, but that's cool, you know?
Yeah. So did you have bands then in California? I mean, did you try and get out there, and or you were just studying and going out and getting inspired?
Yeah, it didn't work out. SC was like a weird place to be. You know, it's like a very, it's an expensive private school in like kind of downtown Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And you know, I had some scholarships, but it was like, you know, it was just a competitive guitar program, and then like not a lot of, there was the like the, there's a big frat scene there and stuff, and just a whole bunch of things were not my thing,
right?
So, and I wasn't about to like start ditching class to go hang out on Hollywood Boulevard. Yeah. You know? So I went back to New York when I was done. And as soon as I got back to New York, actually, well, two things happened during college. One was that this first summer, I came back to New York and I worked as a general assistant at Right Track Recording, which is, I don't know what it's called now. It became Legacy and then MSR now, I think. Okay. It's right on 48th Street. And I spent the summer working there, and during that time worked on, like, with Bruce Springsteen on this live retrospective record, like...
Oh, that five-disc thing?
Yeah, like, okay. 15 years of the E Street Band. Yeah. Like, it was him and Bob Clearmountain coming in, like, every day, you know, mixing two songs and stuff like that. Like, that was going on there. Whiplash Smile Road, Billy Idol's Whiplash Smile Road. Like, they had Steve Stevens, like, sparkle-finished Telecaster in there. And I went in and played it one night, you know, and stuff like that. Thanks, Steve. And... You know, a whole bunch of people came through there because it was a top-level studio, like Whitney Houston.
Wow.
I actually photocopied the last edit of Ooh, I Want to Dance with Somebody, like the lyric sheet. Like, they literally had typed it, and then they'd cut it up, you know, with scissors and retaped lyrics to the page.
In a different order?
To edit the lyrics for her. And then they're like, you take this downstairs, you know, photocopy it. And I'm like reading it, you know, because she's coming off of her first record with How Will I Know and
all this stuff, right?
And I'm like reading this and I'm like, wow, one hit wonder.
Yeah.
Gosh, this is awful. This is, she's expecting to sell records on the, wow, you know. And then, of course, 6 months later,
did you know?
Dance was like, huge. But, I mean, so that's my... you know, particularly since she's gone now, this is an amazing memory. You know, any participation in that whatsoever. And, you know, a whole bunch of people came through, like Brian Adams, like, and just the time with Bruce was amazing because he was everything you wanted him to be.
Yeah.
So, just completely.
So what were you were engineering or tape
just
hopping?
Just a gopher.
Oh, okay.
You know?
I mean, okay.
Just like
like a runner
assistant.
Guy.
Yeah. And I had to, you know, there was the first digital consoles, like the big SSLs. And you had to recall all the settings off the computer and stuff like that.
Right.
So, you know, I did some stuff and everything. It was neat. And definitely, like, I was helping unpack all these. That was one of the first digital things, that Bruce Springsteen retrospective. They had these huge digital machines, and they had them, like, the final edits were being done entirely digitally. So it was like they would mix down to this digital format on one machine, and then they'd have a second one on another machine. Maybe they had three or four of them. So it was kind of like one machine, crowd noise, and then a song on the other machine,
right,
and a fully digital mixer that like wouldn't respond in real time.
Right.
You know, you had to like move the fader ahead of time a little
bit and
stuff like that.
Yeah.
So that's how they were making like the master edit. I was unpacking that on the floor, and in walks Bruce Springsteen, and I kind of look up from it, and he looks at me and he puts his hand out and says, "Hey, Bruce."
That's exactly what you want him to be. That's right. That's what you said. Just a guy like, "Hey, you're working on the floor? Hey, I'm Bruce."
Totally. Got up, shook his hand, and that was it. And that's like, what else do you say, right?
Yeah.
You, if you assume everybody knows your name, you're a dick.
Yeah. No, I think I like that.
Yeah.
That's a real guy. So let me ask you this: when you were doing that, what was your dream at that point? Like, you're working in the studio. Did you want to be an engineer? Did you want to be a producer? Did you want to be a guitar player?
I Tom Scholz thing. Oh, I want to make the records, like that. Which, when you think about it, that's what everybody does now, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's it.
Yeah.
The recording studio is part of the instrument. But at one point, one of the engineers there said, oh, hey, man, I want to do a session. You bring in your guitar and amp, we'll record it, just kind of see, want to... Some of the guys on the downtime would try and do their own thing just to learn the equipment a little better. There weren't so many schools like that were really had real recording programs.
Right.
And I got in there and they all knew I was a guitar player. And one of them said to me, you gotta pick which side of the glass you wanna be on. And I was like, yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And so even though I had connections with the studio manager there, wound up managing A&M in Hollywood, mm-hmm. Maybe within the next 2 years after I had done that, I didn't pursue full-blown being a recording engineer. I just much, much preferred to be a performer.
Right.
I prefer to be a performer over being a studio session guitar player,
mm-hmm.
and a songwriter as well. I kind of prefer those elements. That's why I got into it. I have to be completely honest with myself about that. That's the thing,
But you don't feel like you have to make a choice if you want which side of the glass you want to be on?
Not anymore.
No.
But at some point, you have to choose you have to go for it, right?
Yeah, you have to go for something.
Yeah. So I definitely backed off that to a certain degree. And then when I got done with college, I came back to New York and I hooked up with some really legit New York guys. They had a band called Liquid Hips, and they had all been in or were still in a band called Defunct.
I love Defunct. God damn it. I'm gonna think about it. I was in a band that we covered one of their songs. Truth gonna set you free. You know that song?
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
So this was like the trumpet player, the defunct trombone player, Joe Bowie, trombone player, and this is the trumpet player and the rhythm section. So Kenny Martin and Kim Clark.
Yeah.
We both did the gig at some point. So I did that. And that was just some decent gigs. And I had some gigs with guys that I knew from high school, kind of doing the song, working on writing songs and stuff like that. And then just through hanging out or whatever, I wound up getting this, hearing about these guys called Naked Sun.
Uh-huh.
And they had been signed to Noise, which is a German label, with an international distribution through BMG.
Mm-hmm.
So RCA and BMG were, I don't know, they were like farming up the East Village.
Really?
At that point.
Yeah.
There were a lot of like bands that were signed out of there, and not a lot of them really hit. I think like of the New York guys that were working then, there was White Zombie.
Yeah.
They hit, right? There was Raging Slab.
I remember them.
And then some others like Spread Eagle, and it was kind of like a New York version of Guns N' Roses thing happening or something like that. But not a lot of them really. It was a very marginalized scene, but anyway, these guys had a deal and their record came out, and then like everybody quit. Keyboard player quit, guitar player quit. And I got this gig, because it was very progressive, like really they were way into Vandergraaf Generator.
And, I don't even know what that is.
Oh man, that's like this guy Peter Hamill, British guy. And Fripp would play on their records.
Okay.
This is like kind of super artsy prog stuff from the early 70s.
That's awesome.
It's interesting stuff.
Yeah,
yeah, I'll send you a link.
Yeah,
to check out. Some
I'd love
of the
to
stuff.
Check it out.
So I joined a signed band. You know, yeah. I ditched Liquid Hips and you know joined this signed band.
And that was in the time. Was that like late 80s?
No, that was 90s? That was like 92.
So
like. And this was, I mean, like dressing flamboyantly and big long hair and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And like grunge was knocking at the door, man, you know? So I was just completely out of sync with anything that was.
Were you into any guys that were like around? Because there were some, like before Super Unknown or whatever, there was, you know, some great Soundgarden. So were you into any of that stuff at that time?
I did. I loved Soundgarden.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like the Bad Motorfinger record.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Because that was that year, right?
Probably, well, then, yeah. I remember having that record. I was into it. I don't know, Seattle seemed like a million miles away, and like, how are we supposed to, you know, that wasn't like happening around us. I didn't see, you know, I mean, that
it wasn't
was
happening
a stab.
Here at all.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So it's I don't know, man. It's,
did you guys tour a lot?
No, like it was. It's hard for me to put myself back into my shoes right then, but you know, I was slightly younger than the other guys in the band, and they had gotten a record deal, and so I just assumed that they, you know, knew how to keep the ball rolling from that point. But actually, nobody knew what to do in the wake of, you know, changing tastes and genres and you know, A&R guys moving around from label to label. I'm sure you've heard, you know, everybody, oh yeah, we got our A&R guy got ditched, and you know, the only guys that got the most hopeful guys that got signed out of New York right then were probably D-Generation. Everybody thought D-Generation
right
would be. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Jesse Malin and the guys, you know, and they made two records. They put the same single on two records. They have Rick O'Casey. I mean, it was just never really popped into the mainstream for them, and we're sitting there just like, we're not even popular in New York anymore.
Right.
Like, when, you know, Naked Sun used to, like, you know,
really draw.
Be the draw at the limelight, and then by the time I got in the band, it kind of wasn't happening. But I really loved the guys. It was like, you know, we worked hard, we made a record, you know, but we had no deal, and we went to L.A. to shop it, you know, showcase and stuff like that, and that's when Kitaro's manager saw me, and that's how I wound up getting hired by Kitaro.
What a lucky break for you at that point, because what would you have done because the Naked Sun wasn't going to happen out there, was it?
Well, it didn't.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
I wonder what you would have taken. Your life would have been a completely different thing, because that Kitaro gig led to so much other stuff.
Yeah.
So, when did you start playing with him? In like 93? 94.
Yeah.
And you played with him for like 5-6 years?
Five years. Yeah.
How was that?
I mean, it was amazing, you know. I think of myself as being really young, you know. I wasn't, you know, there are people who leave high school and they go straight into playing guitar professionally, and they're already got touring gigs by the time they're 21. I'm probably, I don't know, how I was in my late 20s at that point, mid-20s or something. But it was mildly overwhelming because everybody in the production was like a salty dog.
Yeah.
Lots of salty dogs in the production on that. They'd all worked for the Tubes.
Oh god. So they've been through it.
And we were like, we were young, and they all, you know, there was definitely some members of the production that, you know, perceived me along with some of the other people in the band as being, you know, kind of like walking into a, you know, like having it all served up for you on a silver platter, like you've never really done it. I was like, well, I did drive across the country in a van that I, you know, bought with four other guys and broke down in Tucumcari, and you know, I mean, I've done those things.
Yeah, you paid some dues, yeah.
Yeah. but it's hard. Once somebody has an imprint in their head of like, oh, there's the young guy who just, you know, thinks he owns the world right now. And, you know, people don't know what Kitaro is or does. I mean, at that point, we did some pretty awesome shows in Japan. Like, it was, like, big, you know, festival-sized stages right. in front of Himeji Castle and, like, with, wow. like, a pseudo... I mean, it was totally Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
Like, if you talk about walking into the gig you were made to play, right. it was, like... I literally got the call from Kitaro's manager, like, do you play a Fender Stratocaster? I was like, yeah. And he's like, okay, because we want somebody who can play like David Gilmour. That was it.
Yeah.
That was the spec.
Yeah.
I'm like, you're going to pay me to do that? That's awesome. yeah, man. Like, you know, it's like, where did this
I've been
gig...
ready to do this since The Wall.
Totally.
So I read this thing in there about, I was reading it this morning, an interview with you in Guitar Player magazine, I think, and it talked about bending notes in tune,
yeah.
which is an interesting thing. I've heard guitarists that can't bend in tune, and I don't think I necessarily always bend in tune, but to see someone say like that's actually like something you can work on and make it like a thing, I mean, that...
Yeah, I think the very first demo that I ever made of songs that I had written, the first note of the first solo was a bent note.
Right.
And I realized how many times I had to take it to get it right.
Yeah.
And right there, it was just like, that's like a real thing. And then,
yeah.
you know, everything in David Gilmour's style is, you know, is bent notes.
Yeah.
And so it's just like, that's... And it's so funny because you fast forward all the way to... me sending a video of me playing with Kitaro to the Trans-Siberian Orchestra guys and the MD at the time, Bob Kinkle, when I get on the phone with him, he was like, yeah, man, bending in tune.
You got the gig. Yeah. Oh, that was the guy that said, yeah.
Yeah. As, you know, it's one of those lessons, you know, that you have to have been confronted with. You have to record yourself and listen to yourself back. But yeah, so the Kitaro thing was, you know, that's what he wanted, man. He wanted it like David Gilmour. And, you know, I at that point I had, you know,
Hang on. What? I'm sorry, I don't need service.
No,
thank you.
Welcome.
Sorry, I forgot to put the do not disturb up there. So, that Trans-Siberian Orchestra thing, like when you got, that's huge production.
Yeah, it's insane.
And I mean, I've seen videos, I guess, since I've met you, and I remember seeing the commercials before I met you, like when, you know, it was Christmas, you know, here they come. And, it's fire, explosions, hydraulic lifts.
Yeah. Yeah, mechanized lifts. I don't know how much
lifts,
sorry. Hydraulics. Yeah, I would say that too. But yeah, I mean,
the coolest thing is I saw a thing that looks like when you open Kiss Alive 2. that's what I thought.
The
like,
Love
yeah.
Gun lifts.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. We had those 1 year. Those are the lifts.
Did they have little things so you don't fall off like they did? That's awesome. You actually had you played on the Love Gun lifts.
I mean, that's what they tell us, but they'll tell us whatever.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's just, you know, if we talk about how did I get here,
yeah.
right? Just staying in it for long enough. Like, I think we talked about this after
that's
a song
true.
Revision session
yeah.
once. So it was like, you just stay in it for long enough. You know, the world gets really pretty small,
yeah.
like the people that have stayed in it. Like,
yeah.
on that Kitaro tour, the violin player, Lorenza, she's like one of the most workingest violin players in the entire, like, pop music thing. You've seen her with, you know, Bon Jovi and Hall & Oates and Sheryl Crow. And
wow.
I mean, she's like...
Everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. And I think after the Kitaro thing, she did John Tesh for a while, and then maybe went to the Sheryl Crow. You know, she's had an amazing trajectory to her career. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you know that Einar is married to John Tesh's niece?
I did not know
yeah.
that.
Leslie Tesh.
Wow.
Go ahead. Sorry.
So you know, and so the people that have stayed in it, you know, like if I just stayed in it long enough, I'm thinking, you know, the Kitaro thing kind of got to be like less and less touring each year until like 99, and we did this kind of ill-fated, there was an ill-fated like Southeast Asian run where we arrived in Hong Kong only to be told by the road manager, so we're canceled here.
God, you go all the way to China. It's not even like driving to...
But it was like we were just canceled in Hong Kong. We still had a date in China, and then we had some dates in like, I don't know, Jakarta or something like that. You know, which, you know, is the luxury of, at that point, it's the luxury of being a sideman. You're getting paid weekly, and you've got nothing but time off in a pretty good hotel in Hong Kong. You know?
Right.
So that was, you know, trips to the beach and, you know, something
like that.
You got
to see the world in that time, huh?
Yeah, because I had never traveled before getting the Kitaro gig. So I got that, and it was like, hey, Japan for 6 weeks, you know? And like I hadn't really eaten sushi. And my girlfriend at the time took me out. She's like, you're going to have to learn how to eat. Turns out it would have been more appropriate to teach me how to eat noodles.
Yeah.
I think would have been the,
yeah.
the thing. But yeah, that was amazing, you know, all through that period. And then, and there was some European stuff towards the end that was really cool, you know.
Yeah.
And it was a great organ, you know, working with Kitaro was great. You know, his people were great. You know, the surly gang from the first couple of tours wound up getting, you know, kind of shuffled about, and it wound up being a very good working situation for me and everybody in the band. So, you know, it was good.
Yeah.
I really had a good time. And then, but it did kind of dry up. Well, the last thing I did with him was a holiday tour, which is pretty interesting given what I do now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then there was about 2 years there where I, you know, went back to like songwriting classes and took a lot of voice lessons and was still working on possibly, you know, toying with how I could pitch songs that I had written possibly as an artist or, you know,
two artists.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah. So, you know, I spent a good amount of time on that, you know, finding out what, you know, the kind of do's and don'ts of the, you know, lyric writing.
Yeah.
You know, how to not sound trite and how to...
That's interesting.
I think my lyric writing was all so... I mean, I would have been a really good, like, maybe... like Linkin Park kind of lyricist, you know, kind of like, I'm really upset.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I don't know why. Kind of, that would have been like about the level of my ability as a lyricist up until kind of taking some classes and finding out, like, you have to actually tell people what you're singing about in some way.
Yeah.
And if you make a choice to obscure the facts of the matter in some way, make sure it's a choice. Make sure it's not just that you can't be honest with yourself as a lyricist, like about what is bugging you or what's making you happy or whatever. So that was really interesting. And then Marty Friedman gave my name to the TSO guys, and that got me kind of back in the sideman game.
So what's the schedule with that? I mean, do you guys go like November and December to January or something? Or
yeah, well, when I first started, so they first launched the tour in 99, and I think they only did like 10 shows. Like one band did 10 shows. Then in 2000, they in a stroke of genius, they decided on the two-band concept so that they could play the maximum number of markets in the Christmas alley.
Right.
And I'm not sure if that was each band did 3 weeks or something like that. Probably started after Thanksgiving, went up until Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when I got the gig, it was the same. 2001 is when I got the gig, and it was the same kind of schedule. It's like we started right after Thanksgiving. I might have had Thanksgiving at home that year. It would have been the last time I've had Thanksgiving at home. It would have been 2001.
Right.
And right up till Christmas. I think I got home for Christmas. It was like 4 weeks. And then it got longer. So then it went up to New Year's Eve. And then it started starting the week before Thanksgiving.
Right.
And the longest it ever... And it used to rehearse in New York. So that was pretty convenient.
Yeah.
And the management's New York based and everything. Mm-hmm. So that would... So I would be home right up until just before Thanksgiving. and then I get home on New Year's Eve. Then the biggest it got with the original show, the Christmas Eve and Other Stories show, was, you know, like the first show date was like November 2nd or 3rd.
Wow.
And rehearsals were out of town. Wow. So I would be gone by October 13th or 14th.
Wow.
So, and it went past New Year's, went to January 4 or something like that, 4 or 5. That's the longest it got. So I don't know, what does that put it at? Like, that's all of November. That's almost three months.
Yeah.
Almost 3 months.
Wow.
And then it kind of tightened up. Like, because, and for good reasons. I don't think it wasn't just like, you know, it wasn't lack of interest. It was, you just, it's kind of, they're so respectful of their audience. It's awesome. I mean, they're like, you know, we want to give people the most amazing show we can for a reasonable ticket price.
Right.
We want to give the people like what they want from us, as well as what maybe a lot of people want from a holiday show in some way, you know.
Right.
But what they want from the TSO is more than just a holiday show, because you know there are records that are non-holiday records, and there, you know, there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of history there with the Sabotage thing, stuff like that. People want that. You know, we can't just do the happy fun Christmas stuff, because we got flame going off and lasers. Know what I mean? Yeah. It has depth. You know, it's so in the way that it tightened up is that, you know, the business end of it is that, you know, you have really strong markets, and you figure out how to get them on weekends, you know, Friday, Saturday, so that like the most people can come in the markets where they really want it. And then you manage, you know, the band, how tired the band can deal with, and crew, more the crew than the band, because
it's a huge set and
hardest working crew ever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're amazing. So, you know, they put us on, we're on a fairly reliable, like 5 days on, 2 days off for the bulk of it. But when you get into the Christmas thing, man, I mean, we'll do 6 days on, you know, 9 shows in 6 days or something like that will happen. You know, things will happen due to the needs of the schedule still. But it's much smarter. So now it starts around November 15th. Mm-hmm. And the last show is the day before New Year's Eve.
Okay.
So I'm gone from like Halloween up to New Year's Eve. And I think they're on the mark. They're getting the, you know, they have to alternate. Some markets like can't get the show every year because the show's, you know, because the schedule's a little tighter. So, you know, it's kind of like, hey, we didn't make Boise this year, but we'll be back, you know, next year.
Right.
And they've got such a great fan base at this point that people will, you know, will either drive on that year or wait and still be there for you, you know, next year. It's amazing.
Yeah, when I told my, I can't remember when it was. I guess it was just a month ago. I was with my family, and my aunt was asking if I had done any more of those things, and one of my cousins asked a song division thing. And he was like, "Oh, what's that?" And I was like, "Oh, now that explained who you and Roto were." And when I brought up the TSO, he was like, "Oh, like I go see that every year, like every time I can." He's like, "Have you ever seen? It's amazing. Like it is like it's a show." So those rehearsals, man, they're long. You have to work out your blocking and everything too, don't you? I mean, because you don't want to do a James Hetfield and Catch on Fire. Or
no, no. Thankfully, that no one's there. I mean, I got Spinal Tap inspired, you know, stories for days.
Are there any like, what's the thing where they come out of the cocoon and the dude's like stuck in it the whole time, Derek?
Almost. Like, I mean,
there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of moving parts in that show.
Yeah. So rehearsal we've done for the last few years in a place called the Mid-America Center, it's right next to Omaha.
Okay.
And it's like right across the river in the next town on the other side. Because in Omaha they have the Quest Center, the Key West Center, or I don't know what it's called now.
Right.
It was less. Anyway, so So we have the whole arena. We book out the whole arena, and you put one stage at one end and the other stage at the other end. And the lighting rigs are, like, fighting for
space.
For space. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And there's always been a remote stage for the last, like, 5 years or so. So those sit at the kind of in the middle at the sides, you know, for you to, because it's a lift gag.
Right.
And and then we have these locker rooms and other rooms, like, along this hallway.
Right.
And basically, you, like, the band will go into this locker room, which is really just set up like, you know, any rehearsal room you've ever been in, complete with personalities and everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And we run the music.
Right.
And, you know, 99% of the people in there are completely off book. Like I rarely have to, you know, pull out a piece of sheet music. Sometimes, you know, my part will double a cello part, and the easiest way to figure it out is to get the cello music or something like that. But then the whole ethic is to approach it as a rock band.
Right, right.
You know, like, that's the point. It's not like a chart reader's scene.
Right, right.
You know? So we get in there and we just run the stuff down, and then we'll have a couple of singers show up early to kind of mark through the stuff. Mm-hmm. But there's a big cast of singers.
Right.
And so once they're all there, then they have a room where they're working on choreography, and then they'll come in and sing their parts with us and all this. And this is all in the back
room. That's awesome.
And while we're in the back room, you know, the other band can be on the stage. For the first couple of days, we're all in the back rooms because they're building the stage.
Right.
And then once the stage is, like, generally...
Which I'm sure takes some rehearsing, too.
Oh, yeah.
Well, they have to go through building it a couple times.
And you have to go out there, and then they show it to us. And we have a safety demo.
Right.
And we have, like, a pyro demo. But you will have a safety demo just for the basic stage. Like, you can go here, don't go here. You can go here, don't go there, or whatever.
Right.
Then we have, like, the safety demos for the lifts. And that's, you know, I've been the guy riding the lift for a while now. And it's fine with me because I love the attention. And it's just like... The first time you ride, you haven't done it for like 8 months. It's like, you know, your palm gets ready. It's like a little, and then it's just like the first time they put the pyro off, you know, because we play in those tux jackets.
Yeah.
And if you do it the first time you go up, and they run the big ones at the back of the stage are called, there are two. There's the dragons and the fire screens, but it's mostly fire screens now that they use, and they're made by a company called Pyrotech, and they're awesome.
Nice.
They go, okay, we're gonna go for a long one. It's like, and you're standing, you know, I'll be there with my guitar on and just a t-shirt.
Yeah.
And they hit it, and it's like, you know, you feel it on your hair, on the hair on your arms and stuff, and it's like, and you're like, I don't remember it being that hot. And it's
it's that hot.
But then the thing is that, like, running, doing the, like, we've been doing these mechanical arm gags for the last, like a fireman's lift almost, you know, where you're just on a platform with a T-bar that you're attached to.
Right.
And it's so much more scary with the lights on and nobody in the crowd than it is when you've got your in-ear monitors in and you're playing the music and, you know, spotlights in your face, you can't see hardly anybody and stuff like that. It's a piece of cake at that point, you know. But the first time,
it's freaky. How much does a show change year to year?
Well, a lot the last, like, 3 years.
Because, that's good.
Yeah. We, you know, the first half of the show was the story of Christmas Eve and other stories for the first, for, you know, up until 2 years ago. And then we changed the first half and put in... the third Christmas album, and the back half of the show has been usually like a mishmash of stuff from the other holiday records that we're not doing in the first half,
right?
And or stuff from Beethoven's Last Night and Night Castle, which are non-holiday records,
right?
And whatever, and then Paul has also, you know, Paul O'Neill, who's the boss, he's also, you know, he kind of stayed true to being known as being really good at doing a holiday song by putting out a couple of singles over the last few years that are you know good. So those will get featured in the back half as well. Okay. Like we did the Nut Rocker, which is kind of like our version of the ELP. It's that da 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 da, but it's on. It's over like you know, like a swing, like an R&B feel, and then we did this one, Fireflies, which is one we did single that came out last year. So there'll be that stuff and some vocal tunes and previewing some stuff from records that are going to come out, as well as like, you know, bringing back in maybe some old Sabotage stuff. So it's kind of like the back half, everybody that like likes coming to the show is like, back half's where you guys, you know, take the gloves off.
Right.
Go, you know, rock out and the flames get hotter and stuff like that. So it's still fun, man. I mean, you can't, it's such a rare opportunity. I'm nothing but grateful when I'm on that stage and it's just like, I can't believe it.
Well, it's great. It's so, you guys were in Austin at Christmas.
I should have called.
I know. I should have called.
I assumed everybody had family plans.
Well, I was going to stay with my family until like the 27th, but I came home Christmas morning, and then it was like I think it was like the next day I saw that it had happened the night before, and I was like, oh shit, I wonder if Anna's here. So, how did you end up in the band for the rock? Play
Rock of Ages.
Rock of Ages, sorry.
So just to talk about the Christmas in Austin. So yeah, it's like my family. So my family came.
Yeah.
And so I'm triply distracted, you know, at that point because it's just, you know, it's like it's my wife and my daughter, and it's awesome that they're, you know, willing and able to come and see me, but it's also a complete three-ring circus, you know, making sure everybody's happy and, you know, taking care of the show and the whole thing, you know, so it's like, and we have great people taking care of all that, but it's a really big organization, so you can't, like, push, you know, it's my family, they're my responsibility.
Right.
It's not fair. So, If we backtrack about 5 years, which has gone by in an instant in my life, my daughter was born in April of 2009, and I was working on Song Division, and the TSO had become fairly reliable. Because it's they're under no obligation to call me every year, and that's as it should be. You know, it's like everybody that does that gig, you know, works really hard all year and you know, maintains themselves as a professional, and that's why we keep doing the gig.
Yeah,
they don't know that I'm gonna do that every year.
Yeah.
You know, so. In the middle of the year, so 2009, like the economy's still recovering from the 2007, 2008, you know, right? So Song Division, you know, meetings and conventions industry, you know, was very hard hit through those years. And you know, it's an interesting thing, like the touring sideman, particularly now that I have a child. You know, you're not going to go. I'm not going to go trying to hunt down too many other touring gigs, pop or rock or whatever. There are some of those bands from the '80s that are still touring, and sometimes they need guitar players and stuff. And that's all, you know, good work. And friends of mine do that work. So my wife basically said, "You need some in-town work. You need to go." Figure that out. And I was working on the first Daredevil Squadron record at the time. Mm-hmm. And the singer, Andrew, said to me, "Dude, you should find out about doing Rock of Ages, man. Like, you know, it's like the first thing that happens is dude comes down there and like rips this tapping solo, like Face Melter, and then, you know, and then it's just like nothing but, you know, rock tunes for 2.5 hours. I was like, all right. So the studio in here in Brooklyn that that we were using, that I had used for my Your Last Battlefield records, is an instrumental record,
right.
I did, and then we used it. I just did the guitars for Your Last Battlefield there, and then we used it for most everything except for the basic tracking of the Daredevil Squadron record. Mm-hmm. And those guys, one of those guys, well, I guess both of them that own and operated the studio, go way back with Constantine Maroulis,
yeah.
who's the original lead in Rock of Ages. And I said, they need subs on that, and they very nicely gave my name to Connie, who gave my name to Tommy Kessler, who's on guitar too in the show, and he also plays for Blondie.
Okay.
He's out with Blondie right now. And I went in and met with Tommy, and it was a good fit. I actually knew a bunch of the guys. This is back to that. Whoever sticks
smaller.
Around,
yeah.
man, the world gets small.
Yeah.
Like, the rhythm section, Winston Roy, who's currently in Soul Asylum now, as well as being Rock of Ages' bass player.
Yeah.
And the drummer, John Weber, I mean, we're almost exactly the same age. It's like, we didn't really know each other, though.
Right.
But it's like, were you? And it's, yeah, oh, man. Or, did you ever play with this? I was like, yeah, I played with her. Oh,
yeah.
You can never get paid by her.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
like
yeah.
you know, like a million stories about the same people. It's just had never really, you know, done gigs together or
yeah.
anything. So that was an amazingly good fit. And it turned out that I had some mutual acquaintances with Joel Hoekstra, who was the lead guitar chair.
Mm-hmm.
So I did guitar too for, I don't know, probably 6 months or so before I cross-trained over on a guitar one. And now I sub on both chairs. So this coming weekend, I'm going in on guitar one for Joel. And then at the end of the month, or actually on the 12th, Thursday night, I'm playing guitar two.
Okay.
And then the weekend, I'm playing guitar one.
Wow.
And then at the end of the month, I'm playing guitar two. And yes, I do play the wrong part sometimes.
Yeah. Do you get in trouble for that, or no, they understand?
Oh, I've built up a wealth of goodwill at this
Good.
Point. But I mean, it's funny. Like the worst guitar, the rhythm guitar chair can train wreck the whole show,
right?
Because you play more than words on an acoustic guitar,
right?
Backing up just the female lead,
mm-hmm.
and you can. Joel says it's like driving a Lamborghini into a brick wall. Like, everybody knows you did not intend to do that.
Yeah.
You know, when
yeah.
something like that happens on stage, it's just
yeah.
like, there's no, it's like, that's on purpose. No,
yeah.
that's
yeah.
not on purpose. yeah, it's great. It's a great show.
Is
it's
the
hilarious.
Band on stage in that show?
Yes.
I've never seen the show. I saw the movie, though.
Well, you're leaving tomorrow?
I'm leaving tomorrow. That was an invitation. The world is small when you stay in it long enough. You know, Constantine came to a show that Skyrocket was playing in Houston, and I knew who he was, and so I went up and talked to him. We got him to come up and sing with us. He was doing Toxic Avenger, like, getting
yeah.
it ready to bring it up here.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Yeah, I remember
really
when
nice
he was doing
guy.
That. Yeah. Yeah, and I played in his band for a while. You know,
yeah.
We did a... There's a video on YouTube of me playing 25 or 64
uh-huh.
with him. It was mostly covers. He was doing kind of a, you know, vocal interpretations of the American rock songbook kind of a thing. You know, like it's kind of updating the, you know, Rod Stewart and all these guys started redoing
sure.
the Tony Bennett
right.
kind of songbook. It's kind of like he was taking a little more of that. Because he's got an amazing voice.
He's got an amazing voice.
You know, and he can rock that. So you can rock some of that Skyrocket material.
Yeah.
Some of that smooth 70s.
Yeah, what did he sing? Oh, he sang Brown Eyed Girl.
Yeah.
That was the one he knew the words to. Anyway, so.
But he was doing, like for that thing I was doing, he did 25 or 64. He did, what's the 10cc tune?
I'm Not in Love, Things We Do For Love.
Yeah, yeah, I'm Not in
Love. Yeah.
And some Hall and Oates and, you know, some
yeah.
stuff like that. And yeah, I mean, he makes it nice. It's
yeah.
good. It's
yeah,
good.
He's a great singer.
So yeah, I mean, it's been a Rock of Ages has been just great. It's a good time. It's nothing but a good time.
Yeah.
And still have a good time doing it. And, you know, it's just what my wife was hoping I could get a little bit of in-town work. Yeah. But, you know, the Songvision thing has significantly picked up over the last 2 or 3 years. We're just really excited about what we can do, and we're always doing new things. We've got, like, you know, Songvision's rock and roll game show. We've got, like, a ton of different things that are great entertainments in the corporate market that also function as team building and things like that.
Right.
I still, you know, really enjoy doing it because we just, you know, like with finding you and the people you work with, like, when we find the right guys to do Songvision, they have fun with it.
Yeah.
And it's not like, there's a double-edged sword in the corporate, like, non-ticketed market of the marquee artists that are willing to book themselves out in that. You know, it's like, I think some people work for companies are like, you know, we got the Black Eyed Peas to do our, you know, our Christmas party.
Yeah.
And then other people are like, we got the Black Eyed Peas? You know, it's kind of like, you know, so by using guys that are, you know, more in the sideman zone, aren't like the artists.
Right.
But still enjoy doing what they do.
Yeah.
Finding that right mix is, you know, is where it gets really fun. And then, you know, it's like our Australian team did this event last year and, like, had Richard Branson crowd surfing.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, it's like, totally crazy.
You know, like, I had great interchanges with some of these really high level, you know, executive guys, and they just care about what they do. They want their people to have a good time.
Yeah.
And they want to do something, you know, right for them, you know, to keep them interested and know that, you know, that everybody has to work for a living, man. You know, so you gotta make it good for people, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's like half of anybody's job is enjoying the people you work with.
Yeah.
Like a band.
Yeah.
You know?
Like the hang is super important.
Totally.
And in fact, sometimes you'll take someone, but not with much less talent, but you take someone that might not be as super over the top proficient just because they're easier to be with for a long period of time, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I've done that before in bands. Like, I know this guy's really good, and this guy isn't as good as him, but shit, this guy I can actually talk to or, like, you know, communicate with and get, you know, the point across.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So, it's, all that stuff's at play, and I'm fascinated by it. And it keeps me engaged with all the different things that I do. So it's like, you know, right now I'm working on some recording some Daredevil Squadron stuff.
Right, I saw some videos of that.
Yeah, everybody in the band has a lot going on, both personally and professionally. So it's a little bit, you know, it's got that labor of love associated with it at this point. But we're always hopeful that there'll be more success involved down the road. And I don't know, it's just like,
what about your solo stuff? You did one solo record in 2004 and then you did the instrumental record.
Yeah, I'm starting to percolate some ideas about that. I might do I wrote that record Grace Period was lyrically involved with, I don't know, feeling like well, you know, I had my daughter late in life, right? So I feel like I had this, like, a lot of us who've gone into music, it's like you've got this extended grace period on making any of these decisions.
Grown-up decisions.
Before you die.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, and so that's kind of the line in the song was like, my grace period is over, kind of a thing. But I think I'm warming up to a grace period too, which has a neat tie-in with some of the events in my last, you know, since I made that record, which is a while now. And then the battlefield that was called Angus, is just under Angus Clark, is called Your Last Battlefield. And I think I've done one or two shows, you know, where I just call it Angus Clark's Battlefield. I've, you know, I've got ideas about what the next thing would be about, but I'd have a tough time coming up with that many Star Trek references in my song, because all the titles on that record were Star Trek references. Yeah, which is really funny, because one year I was on the autograph line with the Trans-Siberian Orchestra, and I'm sitting next to, like, one of the singers who's significantly younger than I am, and this kid comes through, had to be like 12, And he's like, you're kind of nervous, like, because he had a question prepared.
Right.
And he was like, your solo record is called Your Last Battlefield. Is that a Star Trek reference? I was like, yes, it is. As a matter of fact, all of the song titles on that record are references to Star Trek, the original series.
Yeah.
He's like, that's awesome. And the singer I'm sitting next to is like, that's true. Like, yeah. She's like, you're a total dork.
Yeah. We have to be. So, I also have seen many of your lessons online.
Oh, yeah, man. That came out of a clear blue sky. One of my best friends in the world is a guitar player in New York named Jeff McElane, and he referred me to the folks at True Fire, and they just have a great working system. Like, because I don't come from a teaching background,
right?
So it was neat for me because, like, they make it pretty manageable for somebody who's more focused on, you know,
just playing,
yeah, and performing. So it's down in Florida, and they fly you in. It's like a 2-day shoot. And it's a lot of fun. It's really interesting to me, though, in terms of, like, the YouTube thing. Like, YouTube is now, like, flooded with, you know, instructional stuff and almost no performance stuff.
That's true.
Like, I got to tweak my YouTube presence.
Yeah, you
got to
switch it out.
Presence, you know? Yeah.
There's also an Angus Clark Tai Chi guy.
I know.
That's what I noticed when I was looking up stuff.
Yeah, I know.
So what's next for you this year? More Song Division and then hopefully a TSO tour? When did you find out about that? Like, when did they let you know? Summertime? Or?
Well, I feel pretty secure about it because they actually already got me, like, another guitar.
So. Oh, okay.
Feeling pretty good, but I am already in the gym.
Yeah,
it's like, that's part of the whole thing, man. It's just like the physical demands of the show, and making sure the tux still fits. You just gotta keep on point with all that stuff. So, and you know, as you get more advanced in years, you can't, like, let it slide. You can't yo-yo through the year. You know, you have to kind of stay on it. Yeah. So that's already in the works. But right now there's Song Division stuff on the calendar, which is awesome. And then there's a bunch of, like, because Joel also plays for the Trans-Siberian Orchestra. Joel at Rock of Ages also plays guitar for the Trans-Siberian Orchestra. And he also plays guitar for Night Ranger.
Oh, awesome.
So Night Ranger does a lot of work in the summer, and Blondie's out on a tour right now.
Right.
So that's why there's a whole bunch of stuff coming up down at Rock of Ages. So I'll be down there. And then there's a couple of Song Division things next week. And then there's another one. There's a couple in July and August. And then I've got all this Daredevil Squadron recording.
Going on
right now. And we're hopeful to put that in the can before we leave for the tour. So that'll be... Doesn't seem like a tight deadline, right? Because, like, I'm sure
it
the
is.
First and second Sabbath records were made in a week.
Yeah.
And I don't think I could do better than that.
Yeah.
So there's, it'll, you know, it's going to go by like this, you know. So
yeah.
I'll be out there doing TSO. Yeah. Probably first show is about November 15th.
Wow. Well, man, I guess we come to the end. Is there anything I'm missing? Did I forget something? Did we forget something?
No, man. You are an awesome researcher, in addition to being an amazing singer.
Oh, thanks, man.
Keyboard player and guitar player.
Thank you.
It was fun seeing Skyrocket here in New York.
Yeah, it was a good time. It was fun playing. I love that place. For some reason. I was feeling a little ill to my stomach, though, before the show, and it's tough to be in a barbecue place when you're feeling a little nauseous. Like, just such a strong smell of food that it was like, it was a little tough, but I made it. Isn't that interesting? Like, you can feel like shit, and as soon as 1, 2, 3, 4, just a matter of seconds, it goes away.
Yeah.
What is that, adrenaline?
That's adrenaline.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great cure-all.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Well, I mean, I don't know. It sounds like what part of what drives you is the same thing that drives me. It's the sound of the applause.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Just like once it's on, it's on. Being part of well, you came and did a Song Division gig not that long ago. You had your hand,
yeah,
like all bandaged up.
Check it out. I broke my thumb, but it's getting better.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's, you know, part of it's being kind of basically indestructible.
Mm-hmm.
Like I didn't you know, stay home sick from school very much when I was a kid.
Right.
And I don't know, maybe that just sticks with you. Like I go from my apartment down to this practice space that I keep to you know, play guitar loud, uh-huh, and everything, and record and everything. And it takes about 20 minutes walking. There's not really a bus line or anything that'll do it. So I got a bike last year, you know, saved myself 40 minutes a day, you right. know? And sure enough, within about 3 weeks of having that bike, I wiped out and went right down on my right, used my right hand to stop myself, you know, when I hit the ground.
Yeah.
And I couldn't do push-ups, like, you know, for the whole tour. I couldn't put any weight on right. my hand in that way. But I could still play.
Yeah.
And probably playing is, you know, good for it, you know, in any way. But man, you just get, you know, you get panic stricken, like something's yeah. going to go wrong. And
yeah, I mean, when I did that, I was like, wow, this, I could have done something that would take me out of the game for a while. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's terrifying. So yeah, I think there's so much riding on being able to perform when, you know, when it's yeah. go time, that you know, definitely all your bits and pieces have gotten the message over the years.
Yeah, so it's yeah,
like,
definitely.
It's like, you know, you might feel sick, but man, once it's time to go,
it's time to go.
Yeah.
Well, man, thank you for coming to my hotel. It's great. I'm glad that we know each other. I've had a great time getting to know you and hanging out with you, and I'm glad we did this because now I know even more about you.
Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks.
It's good to be here. It's shuffling its beams like a dealer at dawn. The new day is breaking on my heart aching for you.
My man, Angus Clark, man. What a great guy. Great. It was great that he came by the hotel and got to hang out. I'm glad that he came to the Skyrocket show and got to see us jam out. Wish we would have jammed with him. He's a fantastic dude, man. Love that guy. All right. Angus, man, if you're in New York, you know, look him up. See what he's doing, man. He might be doing Rock of Ages. You can go there and check that out. He might be, if you go out and see the Trans-Siberian Orchestra this season, this coming holiday season, he'll be out there jamming. All right. Look, Angus is a great guy. Look him up. Find out his stuff. Look up his music. He is working on a new record with Daredevil Squadron. You will hear a song of theirs in just a minute. And look, if you're in Austin, don't forget, come out Tuesday, July 1st. I will be at Strange Brew playing some music with my friend Jeremy Nail. Will be playing at 8. I'll be playing after him. And then Joseph King, my dear friend from New York City, will be coming down and playing a show here. Okay? Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. Don't forget to like us on Facebook. And you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Johnny Gowdy. All right? Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Angus Clark. Let's listen to some Daredevil Squadron. Let's get down.
Out of the sun. Out of the sun. Blinded as you try to turn, dive and roll away. All the many tricks you've learned are failing you today. Closer now and closer still, you feel me on your tail. I'll have you in my crosshairs soon and let the bullets wail.
build your mask, you're choking on your tears. Bandits falling all around, the day will soon be ours. Wreckage on the fields below, you join the other cowards right now. There can be no turning back, we go.
Go!
Daredevil squad! Come diving out of the sun.